an informed, radical black subjectivity from the standpoint of uncolonized mind, critical consciousness, and a concern with ending politics of domination. Now, I think of people in the academy, I think of people like Cornel West. I think of Coco Fusco's new writing, a Cuban black woman. I think of Michelle Wallace, who writes from both within and outside the academy, etc. Attention has been deflected away from the need for a continued black liberation struggle. Many people believe it's come and gone, and we're all as free as we are ever going to be. For political opposition, for struggle, another no-no word. A member of this new radical chic, about, you know, the new radical race chic, shared her sense that struggle is just a tired term, and she's just not into it. Attention is focused instead on the production of a privileged, commodified discourse on race, where race becomes synonymous with culture. Hence, the end topic, race, is separated from political discussions of racism, thereby obscuring the possibility that folks might deal with racism and alter racist perspectives before they do their race thing. That is to say that they might develop a little of that old-fashioned, out-of-style, quote, critical consciousness. That was, of course, the old naughty ingredient which in radical political critique circles linked discourses on race with the effort to end racism. There would be no need for this new crowd of unruly radical black folks to raise critical objections about all this passionate focus on race as the end topic if it were not all so neatly divorced from the recognition of the power of racism. The continuation of racial domination of blacks by whites, global politics of white supremacy, and to use some of those out-of-date, uncool terms, the continued suffering and pain in black life. We witness the dangerous implications of this separation in popular culture. There, in the name of pluralism and a celebration of difference, we find many racist attitudes, same old message, new packaging. I mean, I was struck by a comment that Gayatri used, and I won't be able to remember it exactly. I wrote it in my notebooks. At one point, she said something, and she can correct me, because it was a very well-stated thing about people. There's a way in which, people want to consume. Everybody wants to be the third world. And as you, those of you who know me know that I'm really into fashion. Fashion is the place. I mean, just because I have on these tired clothes today doesn't mean that I can't style given another location. But anyhow, if you go to any store today, you will see, you know, nice pins with black people and other third world people on them. Everybody's wearing their Palestinian scarf. We have all these clothing, and my class on Toni Morrison has been exploring, because we've been reading Tar Baby and looking at Tar Baby as a text that is prophetic to, in the sense of how she sees a certain kind of commodity fetishism growing up around race. I mean, the idea that, in a sense, you can now, you don't have to be worried about hating the other because your attention can be on becoming the other. You know, decked out in your clothes from Africa, your beads, your necklaces, etc. Just last month in Vogue magazine, there was an article on protest music wherein the white male writer referred to Tracy Chapman's buckwheat hairdo. In terms of today's ethnic cool, I imagined he thought he sounded cute, like he was in the know. Excuse me. Buckwheat has never been recovered by black people as a positive representation of our reality. This month's Vogue, and this is a couple of months back, has a blonde white woman on the cover with the heading All American. The inside article is called Everybody's All American. Its point, ethnicity is in, it's marketable, and it's okay. The focal point of the piece is that black, Hispanic, and Asian models who were never able to work in the past can now find jobs. Of course, the article reassures readers that this shift in thought has, quote, less to do with politics than with a keen sense of what people are responding to. One advertising agent asserts, quote, most of our clients, Chrysler, Merrill Lynch, want minorities because they look more interesting, often more exotic, certainly more noticeable. Readers are told that it was once difficult to hire black models because one couldn't see blush or eyeshadow on dark-skinned women. Mind you, we are called girls in the piece. And since when did the majority of black women in the U.S. have dark skin? Let's not stop there. Opening the new January issue of Interview, I read a feature article on Yoko Ono entitled Yoko, Life After Lenin. Interviewed by white male Kevin Sessoms, Yoko Ono talks about Japan's economy. Then suddenly, without transitional shift, she's asked, what is it about Japanese women, Oriental women, that Caucasian men find so fascinating? Nothing in this text suggests that Ono responds critically to this line of questioning. Her answer begins, quote, maybe the Western man is intriguing to the Oriental woman. His response, maybe Oriental women are just better in bed. They know more positions. Is the insertion that tells readers Ono, quote, laughs, there to mediate this racist remark, to make it appear like nouveau ethnic cool? Well, neither of these comments reflect intensive reading of Said or critical consciousness about race. Come on, Yoko, you know better. On the very next page, Ono reveals both an awareness of racism in this society and its impact on how she was represented in the media. Quote, I did about 5 interviews yesterday because the documentary Imagine is opening in Europe. Anyway, I woke up this morning with this kind of pain that I had never realized before. I said to myself, how dare they? Every time I have an interview, I am asked this question, the world hated you. You've been called a dragon lady for the past 20 years. How do you feel about it? Why do you think that happened? You know what that's like? It's like saying, it's like somebody battering a woman and then saying, all of us battered you, but why do you think we did it? I'm the one responsible for telling them why I was battered. Well, let them tell me. They're the ones who did it. The other side of it was Asian bashing. It was as simple as that, quote. After reading this passage, I wondered if Ono did not call attention to the stereotypical racism in the interviewer's remarks because she did not want to be represented once again as assertive, tough, hard as the dragon lady. I mean, recently I was invited to speak at the Harvard Law School by the, you know, Harvard Law, black law students, and I gave what I thought was a very brilliant talk. And as soon as I finished, a black man held up his hand and he got up and said, why do you think black women are so combative? And the predominantly white audience all murmured their approval of this. And again, that's another way. I mean, one of the things that we have to think about is when, just think about what I talked about is if black women want to participate in post-colonial discourse, if we want to have our say, we not only have to speak, write, et cetera, but we have to be willing to push into places where people may not be saying, oh, come in, honey, I'm so glad to see you. And the fact is, there's a tension we have about pushing because after, I call it how people piss on your success, after you get there, somebody says to you, I mean, and one might say that this person was saying to me, honey, your talk may have been brilliant, but you're so combative, you know? Or do you really ever think you're ever going to have sex again being that combative, you know? All of those kinds of codings that affect how women of color in this culture, both from the third world and within the United States, can position ourselves in relations to power. You know, Yoko Ono is a very powerful woman and a very brilliant woman. If you look at her writings on aesthetics, if you look at the way she conceptualizes around art, that kind of brilliance can be deflected away from when people just dismiss her as the dragon lady. Later that same day, I walk to the local bookstore, and I live in a small town, 8,000, and pick up a new book on, quote, the meaning of race in contemporary poetry. Placing it back on the shelf, I move on to film and TV, looking at a new book called Boxed In, where the white male author talks about images of blacks in ways that I found very tiring. Yet it was presented as enlightened critique, as though he had a special understanding of the way we black others see ourselves. I didn't stop there. I went on to the drama section and actually sat down and read. I'm not a big book buyer. Those of you who know me know how I try to borrow your books and read them and give them back. So what I was trying to read there was Driving Miss Daisy by white playwright Alfred Ergy. I don't know if any of you saw it. Integrated play, the two main characters, an elderly white woman and an elderly black man. Now, when the play was hot, it was talked about. I'd been told that it was about this sexual relationship between the two main characters. Well, it's not. No, the play just hints at this at the possibility that Miss Daisy and her black chauffeur are sweet on one another. Reading the play, it was much easier, I think, to see this embedded plot than people who saw it on the screen, because I think it could be made more explicit in the body language of people doing the play. Reading the work, it was easy to see how it relied on certain kinds of sexual, racial stereotypes lying just below the surface to titillate without interrogating these images. Several weeks later, I was visiting my parents, and I'm going to conclude all this very soon, in yet another small town for a few days, time enough to see an array of movies on television: Splash, Roxanne, Revenge of the Nerds, etc. I hope some of you have had the pleasure of viewing these things, because I was fascinated by the way confronting difference, quote, was a consistent theme in each work. Not racial difference, but other markers that set people apart. Each film's didactic message preached that difference should be tolerated or viewed compassionately in the space of privatized individual relationships. In each work, politics, or the public sphere, is not the location where one confronts and accepts difference. Though the nerds want inclusion, and the nerds are a homosexual black man, as you remember, several sort of Yale-type white men, you know, with, I suppose you could find them at Cornell, with, you know, bad-looking clothing and eyeglasses, et cetera, and then you're a sort of glamorous white woman who's sympathetic. Though the nerds want inclusion in fraternity fellowship, it is presented as more an issue of private taste than a public concern about exclusion. Now, what was really powerful was when the nerds can't get acceptance, right, or when they want to triumph, you notice that they rely on militarism. They find those tanks, they dress in the garb of the U.S. Army, et cetera. And I mean, and that just, for somebody like me who doesn't really look at this kind of thing very often, I was just really overwhelmed by that kind of intervention into the notion of how we would deal with difference and with being, quote, left out. Comfortably, the different all long to be included in the status quo. Absence of oppositionality makes difference acceptable. Culturally, there is a willingness to tolerate difference if it is overshadowed by the longing to be included. There is no cultural space for difference that is expressed as radical oppositionality that challenges and changes norms. Pluralism, another end term, has emerged as the last white supremacist ideological stronghold. If difference can be appropriated and included, there is no need for anyone to challenge racism, sexism, class, elitism, or capitalist materialism. Support for pluralism is strong in academic circles, another cultural sphere. We've talked yesterday about the sort of trend to sort of commodify people of color, and I think we gave a real misconception because people sort of evoke the notion that, you know, every university in the United States is going around searching for all the black people that they want to hire, all the people of color. Now, we have to remember that a lot of people are saying this. And actually, when you get down to counting the number of black people and people of color who are there, we are very few in number. And then when you get down to counting the ones of us that are tenured, we're even more few in number. And then when you get down to counting those of us who are full professors and have great chairs and et cetera, you know, the numbers get smaller and smaller. So we shouldn't act like you know, this has had the positive effect of producing this space where we are now people that are populating it. I mean, when I was in graduate school, I was always touched by a lot of my colleagues acting like they had to worry about getting jobs, but not me. And I would remind them, we have never been taught by any black women. I mean, it was fascinating to me that their lived experience should have said to them that if black women are the, quote, commodity that everybody's looking for, why isn't this commodity represented, et cetera? Okay. Support for pluralism is strong in academic circles, another cultural sphere. Practically everyone supports the inclusion of the other as long as the existing structure remains intact. Yes, everyone seems to be clamoring for difference. Only very few people want to deal with it if it's really different. The point is to have the appearance of difference, new actors, same old show. There is little openness in either academic institutions or arenas of artistic cultural production for difference that is oppositional, that would undermine and challenge the status quo, and nobody seems to want any of that difference that is about changing policy. One change in direction that would be real cool, which has already been said here many times, would be the production of a discourse on race that interrogates whiteness. It would just be so interesting for all those folks who are giving us their take on blackness to let us know what's going on with whiteness. Contemporary writing on race, with the exception of some feminist material, rarely includes discussion of the meaning of whiteness, its representation. Race is always an issue of otherness that is not white. It is black, brown, yellow, red, purple even. Discussions of otherness that fail to critically interrogate whiteness, its importance as a category shaping identity and notions of self, reinscribe old paradigms, maintaining a tremendous gap in our understanding. If we really want to understand race and even racism, it may be historically appropriate and politically more crucial to examine the construction of white identity. Cultural critics might want to explore the reasons liberal and radical white people can choose to write and think about race in ways that do not intervene and challenge racial domination when such an action contradicts their sense of themselves as people who are not racist or actively anti-racist. Only an informed critique of whiteness can really determine what forces of denial, fear, and competition are at work, creating fundamental gaps between professed political concern with eradicating racism and the participation in the construction of a discourse on race which perpetuates racial domination. Current intellectual focus on race has prompted many white scholars to begin writing about the other without reflecting on the location from which they write, without examining their standpoint. Or if such reflection takes place, then it should be shared so that we can all understand the process by which the direction of an individual's academic work and thought on the subject of race evolves. Maria has already illustrated very eloquently how many scholars, critics, writers preface work by stating that they are white, as though mere acknowledgement of this fact is sufficient, as though it conveys standpoint, motivation, direction. One of the most damaging aspects of the approach to race as in cultural subject is its power to undermine years of radical oppositional work who are in oppressed people resisting colonization and racial domination, work to raise critical consciousness so that we would all understand the importance of perspective and standpoint. During my graduate years, many of the, quote, feminist professors who taught me and the students who were my peers in the classroom fiercely resisted any insistence that it was important to understand race and racism, that it was most important to begin one's inquiry or exploration from an anti-racist standpoint. Now many of these women are very engaged with producing scholarship focusing on race and gender. Remembering the intensity of their resistance, I want to know about the processes that enabled their perspectives to shift. Understanding that process is important for the development of solidarity. It can enhance awareness of the epistemological shifts which enable scholars to move in new and oppositional directions. Very few of these women write articles reflecting on their critical process, showing how their attitudes change. Hence, it is difficult to know whether crass opportunism informs their willingness to engage issues of race and gender or greater sensitivity and awareness of the need to end racist domination. So just in case some of you may not be understanding me, I have read a number of books by white scholars in galley form that have nothing to do with race, but then a year later they come out with titles, you know, that say black this or black that. I mean, because everyone recognizes that there is this commodity, but it's also very crucial to talk about what kind of scholarship then gets produced in that kind of context. If new critical discussions of race and gender are to be oppositional, then it is necessary for white scholars and the rest of us to rigorously interrogate our critical practice. A recent front page spread in the New York Times book review section featured a review of historian Elizabeth Fox Genovese's new work, Within the Plantation Household, Black and White Women of the Old South, and a short interview with the author. The last paragraph reads, quote, "Ms. Fox Genovese conceded the fact that it felt a bit odd at times to be a white woman writing about black women." Close quote. Quote, "On the other hand," she said, "I am deeply committed to the idea that we all have to be able to study any subject provided we are honest." Close quote. Her comment affirms the idea of a pluralistic intellectual freedom where one can study and write about any subject, even as such an assertion acts to obscure the decisive political role intellectual work has played in supporting, not undoing, ideologies that promote the subjugation and sort of subordination of black people. The evocation of honesty without any ethical clarification does not really convey the serious political ramifications when individuals from a privileged, empowered group interpret, quote, the reality of less powerful, exploited, and oppressed groups. Evocations of pluralism and academic freedom rarely extend to anyone raising the issue of the relevance of black scholars interpreting the history and experience of white people. The absence of dialectical reciprocity, which would ensure that black and other non-white scholars would be awarded grants to work on investigating and studying all aspects of white culture from a standpoint where race would be central, should indicate that the tired colonizer-colonized paradigm continues to frame the discourse on race and the other. White scholars who write about the other in new and interesting ways are not necessarily engaged in a critical process which undermines white supremacy. Yet if that was the political motivation behind current scholarship, the colonizer-colonized paradigm would be challenged. Just as it has been necessary for black critical thinkers to challenge the idea that black people are inherently oppositional. In other words, you know, we're just born protesting. Well, what we know is we're not born protesting. We are not born with critical consciousness about domination, and we're not born with the will to resist. White critical thinkers and third world intellectuals in the first world context must challenge the assumption that mere choice to write about race, difference, the other, does not certify that one is anti-racist or oppositional. While it is crucial that black critical thinkers interrogate essentialist notions of black identity, such questioning should not devalue and delegitimize the authority of experience. One of the dangerous responses to white fears of inverse intellectual domination in the discourse of the other is aroused whenever people of color suggest that we are in a better position to espouse counter-hegemonic truths. Oh, excuse me, I read that wrongly. One of the dangerous responses to white fears of inverse intellectual domination in the discourse of the other aroused whenever people of color suggest that we are in a better position to espouse counter-hegemonic truths is the assumption that we all have this open access to certain ways of knowing. There is a willingness on the part of many third world thinkers, this is as a response, to surrender all recognition of what I would like to call unique and particular, quote, non-accessible vantage points. In feminist circles, white women who recognize the uniqueness of, quote, female standpoint as distinct from male perspective are often enraged when it is suggested that non-white people may be able to approach issues of race and gender from privileged standpoints based in experience. Our ability to accept and learn from thinkers whose work emerges from a location that is not easily accessible is a repudiation of domination. Fear of losing power, the representation of oneself as authority, prevents many scholars from embracing the idea that there are multiple locations, privileged standpoints, locations where one can see reality in ways that cannot be seen by those who do not inhabit a similar place. Oppositional discourse on race necessarily asserts the primacy of ways of knowing that enable individuals to acknowledge gaps in understanding without fearing that such admissions will lead to a loss of status or recognition. It encourages white scholars to repudiate the role of authority in relation to disempowered others, especially if they have been accorded such recognition because they are white. In a cultural context of white supremacy, it should be obvious that work by white scholars about non-white people often receives more attention and acclaim than similar work produced by non-white scholars. This tendency has been rather overt as regards feminist scholarship on race. Works about difference in racism published by women of color who question narrow assumptions about the construction of the category gender were often dismissed by white women. Later, when the same ideas became the basis for new feminist scholarship, when they were deemed relevant, white theorists often devalued the work of women of color by critiquing the style of representation. Our work was often deemed too angry, our tones too aggressive, even as ideas were appropriated. I was reminded of this recently reading the new insightful book by white woman theorist Elizabeth Spelman, Inessential Woman. Much of the discussion of race in this work draws upon writings, the work of women of color, particularly black women. One of the quotes on the back cover by another white woman feminist theorist makes the comment, quote, "The publication of Spelman's book will be a landmark in feminist theory. This is not because of the novelty of the insight on which it is based, but because Spelman is the first to develop that insight in a systematic way and to explore its full implications for theory and practice. Her contribution goes beyond negative critique to positive suggestions for reconstructing feminist theory," close quote. Now, I need not inform you of who's done the, quote, negative critique. Yet many of the suggestions Spelman makes are reiterations of ideas presented by women of color. Her references regarding this work are primarily cited in footnotes. Within white supremacist culture, it is all too easy for white scholars to appropriate the ideas of women of color, using them in ways that duplicate the servant-served relationship. I've written a long piece recently about how that is the historical point of contact between white women and black women, servant-served. Todorov's essay, Race, Writing, and Culture, is a fascinating piece illustrating many of the inner contradictions contemporary white scholars face as they explore the issue of race. Todorov seems quite threatened by the possibility of inaccessible vantage points, spaces white theorists cannot occupy. Even as he can make the compelling declaration that, quote, the restricted universality of the past should be opened up as much as possible until it is able to account for both the diversity of cultures and the differences which exist within one and the same culture, close quote. Racist domination, white supremacy, imperialism, colonization have stood in the way of this inclusive, expanded universality. As future location, unexplored terrain, it cannot be reached unless there is a disruption and unsettling of previously accepted cultural norms, theory and practice, attitudes and actions. In this culture, race is irrevocably linked to racism. To promote discursive practices which deny that connection is to create another instrument of domination. Easy popularization and commodification of race does enable avoidance of painful confrontation. Ethnic diversity can be celebrated and exploited, while the real material and spiritual conditions determining the lot of many people of color, and black people in particular, tragically worsen. If much of the recent work on race grows out of sincere commitment to cultural transformation, then there is serious need for immediate, persistent critique, since much of this work reinforces oppressive paradigms. Committed cultural critics producing work, whether scholarly, artistic, or both, which opposes structures of domination, presenting possibilities for a transformed future, willingly interrogate work on aesthetic and political grounds. Interrogation, then, becomes an act of critical intervention, fundamentally fostering an attitude of vigilance rather than denial.